You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
I just don't know what to say. It's recording. What do I say? Okay, got it.
Welcome to the show, everybody.
Shut up.
Chris, how you doing?
You're listening to the Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Archaeology Show, episode 204.
On today's show, we talk about ancient obsidian tools, cave paintings, and Egypt's oldest mummy.
Let's dig a little deeper and hopefully find a massive pile of gold. Welcome to the show, everybody. Rachel, ¿cómo está?
Oh, Spanish.
Let's see. No, Rachel, it's... ¿cómo está?
¿Cómo está? That's good. That's how are you?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm good.
Yeah.
Thanks for asking. I've been here with you this whole time, so you'd think you would know that, but...
You'd think I would. So why am I speaking Spanish? Because, I mean, why not? But also, we're in Mexico.
Yay! We crossed the border with our RV. We had no hiccups and no issues until last night. Let Chris tell you about that one.
Yeah.
But, well, okay. I mean, the traveling part of it to get here was amazing and smooth and easy. Everybody, if you have an RV, you should totally do it.
Yeah, and I know we always talk about little non-archaeological things, which, you know, that's okay. Some people don't like it, but some people do. But I will tell you that I'm going to tell you two things right now. First off, we're down here for the whole month of February. It's really kind of the end of January as we're recording this, but the whole month of February. And we are with a group called the Escapers. And it starts with an X-scaper. And they're a subgroup of the Escapees, which is a decades-long, really big like group of RVers. Mm-hmm. But the Escapers is a group of, I wouldn't say younger, but they trend to the younger age, but also the working age. So these people, like, there's no activities in the day, for example. It's all in the evening.
Yeah.
So if you're interested and you have an RV, or you're a full sometime RVer or a full-time RVer, you know, check it out.
And if we didn't mention it, this is Puerto Peñasco, which is at the northern tip of the Sea of Cortez, basically.
They call it Arizona's beach.
Yeah, because it's like an hour from the border with Arizona, hour and a half at most. Yeah, like it was a very quick, easy crossover and then a short drive in Mexico on beautiful roads, too. I mean, people complain about the roads in Mexico a lot, but they're great here. It's been great.
Yep. If you're here, anybody refer to Rocky Point? That's the Americanized version. And in fact, it says Rocky Point on all the signs coming in.
It does. So. Yeah, it does. They definitely cater to the American and Canadian tourists coming down for the winter. Yeah.
Anyway, if you are tired of hearing about our RVing things, please let us know. But also, if you love it, we are about to, at some point in time, I don't know when in the future, because I don't want to shoot myself in the foot.
He's on me rolling my eyes when you're like announcing a podcast that we've barely even started talking about.
No, we've been talking about it for like a year.
Well, right.
Yeah, but it's getting closer. So check out Roadster Adventures, R-O-D-S-T-E-R, adventures.com. And that is where you'll find our future podcast, if one exists.
If it happens, it will be there.
It will be there. Obviously, I would tell you it's on all the other podcast services, too. But that's where you're going to see it first, because you have to have a webpage for these things to happen. So it'll be there. You can subscribe to it there, or you can go to all the famous podcast places. So hopefully we'll have that out. When it's really out, we'll be sure to let you know.
Yep, for sure.
All right. In the meantime, let's talk about obsidian and why a whole bunch of Ethiopians a long time ago really liked it.
Yeah, definitely. So we have a news episode this week. There's been some really cool stuff that has come out in the news lately. Yeah. So it was definitely good timing.
You know
why?
You know why? Because it's like January, February, and
people are publishing.
People got out of the field in like September. They finished their articles. They've been accepted. Yeah. And now they're in the news.
Now they're in the news. Right. Totally. Well, and this does kind of seem like one of those situations. So the article that sort of alerted us to this whole thing is called Archaeologists Discover 1.2 Million Year Old Workshop in Mind-Blowing Find.
Yep.
It's always mind-blowing, but whatever. That's fine.
I have never seen a find that wasn't mind-blowing.
Okay. And like really stupidly, this is in Vice magazine, which like normally I'm not into Vice magazine as a source,
but they report on a lot of stuff.
They do, and it's like the article is really great. It's well written. I like the way they reported, other than the use of mind blowing. It's a little bit dramatic, but whatever.
Speaking
journalists
of their
audience,
do
that. And they also link to the original article that the study is published in, which is in Nature. And it is a pay for article, so you can only see the abstract and figures. But just checking out the figures is kind of like fun to do sometimes with an article like this. You can really get an idea of what they're talking about.
Right. I will say as well, you almost never hear these things in the background because I get them out. But just in case, there's a lot of people milling about. We're in a group of RVs.
Yeah.
You'll hear generator sounds sometimes. You may not hear any of this, and I'm just talking for no reason. But either way, I just wanted to preface that.
Yep.
It's called real life podcasting. Get over it. So what was found here is really crazy. Nearly 600 obsidian hand axes in Ethiopia, in an area called Melka Kuntur. I don't know if it's Kuntur or Kuntur or
Kunture.
Kunture, yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
So a hand axe, just to preface this a little bit, a hand axe is literally like the shape of an axe, but not an axe that you would think of as far as like a metal axe from today. They're usually pointed. Think of like a really large leaf-shaped projectile point almost.
Yeah, it's almost like just a big fat biface that you would find in this country, but big.
And biface means worked on both sides.
Worked on both sides, which these hand axes were, of course, because they have a nice sharp edge and usually a point, depending on how well they're preserved.
Right. Probably the most famously known hand axe to archaeologists and people interested in the field is the Acheulean hand axe, which, you know, is more of a Neanderthal thing and earlier.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, 600 obsidian ones. And obsidian is black volcanic glass.
And specifically, they were found all along the Awash River in Ethiopia, in that area. And
near where some other famous stuff has been found.
Yes, a lot of stuff, like eroding out of that bank, right? Yeah. Isn't that where a lot of the paleo...
Lucy was found near the Awash River.
Yeah, paleoanthropological finds have been found here. And I suppose 1.2 million years is almost into the paleoanthropology range rather than like...
It is solidly in paleoanthropology.
Yeah,
paleoanthropology generally deals with either direct human stuff or human... ancestor stuff, so the Homo line and beyond, but fossilized.
Yeah.
If you want to think about it that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're at the very beginnings of human origins here, though. Mm-hmm. And so what was interesting about this area is that these obsidian cobbles were deposited naturally all along this river, probably from seasonal flooding and just like the natural sort of meandering of the river, right?
Yeah.
And hominins would use these cobbles to craft the hand axes.
And the cool thing about this is more than likely they started getting this idea the way a lot of early people did, is they see what nature can do first.
Yeah,
right?
So totally. Yeah.
When you're on a hillside or especially a river where these obsidian cobbles are, you know, rolling down the river during a flood and, you know, when the water recedes and they go take a look, they're like, you know, oh, crap, look at these sharp ass edges on these things. I bet I could cut something with that.
I bet I could use that.
Yeah,
totally.
And then when you're like, well, I don't want to wait for the next flood. What if I just bang these against other rocks and see what happens?
And see what happens. Yeah.
Eventually you start learning that, oh, if I bang it this way, I can make a certain shape. And if I bang it a lot this way, I can make a shape that is in my head and, you know, eventually start teaching other people. And lithic technology is born.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah,
so. I'm sure it was just that easy.
I mean, that's how I do it. So, yeah.
The cool thing about obsidian is that it is very sharp, like you said, but it is also very fragile and very difficult to work with. And I can definitely confirm that because I had a friend who talked me through flintknapping with obsidian one time, like many, many years ago. And
shout out to Luke.
Yeah. Shout out to Luke. I don't know if he listens or not, but anyway, it was so cool to learn how to do it and so ridiculously hard. And I made the lumpiest little thing that like maybe you could call a biface. It was probably more like a scraper though, because I got some good flakes off of one side, but the other side, not so much.
But
so
because it's obsidian, it's you can probably cut something with it.
Yeah. I could cut a person.
Oh my. So now she's talking about cutting people with obsidian and only watches true crime shows. So
watch out. Here I come.
If you are hearing this and you hear the code word, help me. No. So
that's not a very good code word.
It's not really not that good. It's actually the best code word.
Yeah.
Because nobody would suspect it.
Right. Right.
All right. So yeah, obsidian has been famously used in surgeries before too.
Yeah.
Because it's got like a molecule thickness for the edge once it's made, but it dulls super quickly. So you got to like do it and then resharpen it if you're going to do something like that.
Right, right.
Obviously back in the day, they didn't do that, but they would have had to resharpen
but
it a lot.
But that like initial strike is something that's real sharp. Yeah. And they also, to deal with the fragility of it, that's why for any stone, obviously, but for obsidian in particular, that bifacial thing where they're taking flakes off on either side to bring it together to make an edge, that edge is much, much stronger than just like a sharp piece that has naturally flaked off. So that that's part just like a little bit into lithic technology and like why they would do it that way. They indicate that the use of obsidian by early humans was pushed back by 500,000 years in this article. there isn't a lot of evidence of early human obsidian use, but there is some early evidence of it. There's hand axes in Kenya that date to like 700,000 years ago. It is this large concentration of these tools in a single source material. And the really interesting and cool part is that it shows that these early hominins weren't just like reacting to the landscape around them and using random stones to make tools. Mm-hmm. Instead, they developed it as like a workshop, basically. So they were coming to this place specifically to find this material and make these tools. Right. And the authors of the study have a really good argument for why this is true.
Yeah, one of the quotes from the article, because we are linking to the exact article in the show notes, right?
Yeah,
not just the Vice article, but the paper itself. Mm-hmm. But from the paper, they say that they show through statistical analysis that this was a focused activity, that very standardized hand axes were produced, and that this was a stone tool workshop. And of course, some of the ways that they can tell that are you can just look at the hand axes that are left, although there probably aren't any there. Well, there were some. There were some there, of course. There were a lot of hand axes there.
Yeah.
But there were a lot of them taken away, too, if this was a quarry or a workshop, right? Mm-hmm. So, but people are pretty good at taking debitage, which is the remains of making tools. And if you can find like a what we call a locus or a single reduction event where there maybe somebody took a piece and then went and sat by themselves and then flicked off all these things, even if there's nothing left, you can take all those and reconstruct them back into something, mm-hmm. right? And you can kind of tell what it came off of. There's a very sophisticated computer analysis to do that, but it's definitely possible.
Yeah, totally. And I think that it's really easy to focus on the like obsidian being the like cool and sexy part of this and how humans were using obsidian. But it's just, it's almost much more important and interesting that this separation of behavior that happened here, where mm-hmm. people were going specifically to this area to make this specific thing, is actually what's more important, because it indicates like organized behavior was happening much earlier than we had previously thought. And it just adds like a layer of complication to a community and a society that we didn't know for sure was happening that early. So that's what's really cool here.
Yeah. So what all this means basically is that, as with all these articles that we read, is that people were smarter than we thought and more organized. And they found a source, they organized around it. They weren't really in probably bands and tribes, but they could have been in groups, mm-hmm. you know, small groups of people that are maybe undefined and difficult to see in the archaeological record because of how they lived. Mm-hmm. But that being said, they were organized enough to, you know, huddle around this area. This wasn't one person that did all this.
Right.
We know that, right? So, because that would be almost impossible. Mm-hmm. I mean, it wouldn't be impossible, but unlikely, I guess is the right word.
It had to have been people going back to that same place, like, over a long period of time.
And not only people, but more than one person.
Yeah,
for sure. That's the whole point.
For
so,
sure.
Every time we say, oh, you know, you read in a textbook or you read in a thing that says, oh, humans were this and this and this, and they make these definitive statements, you always have to understand that they mean, as far as we know, mm-hmm. it's just not said that way, right? So when we push back the timeline of something by X number of years, that's just because now we have new evidence for that.
Yeah.
You know,
it is the hard part about paleoanthropology in general, is because just because you haven't found evidence of something doesn't mean it wasn't happening. It's the evidence just hasn't been there yet.
Right.
So you can't assume that something wasn't going on. And that is, I think, a pitfall of pseudo-archaeology and people in that area, is they think, well, because there's no evidence, therefore it was not happening. And that's just not the case.
Well, something else that may not be the case is writing getting pushed back almost twice as long as we thought it was. So let's talk about that on the other side of the break. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 204. And now we're pushing back writing, but we're doing it in the form of rock art, which is the only way we could really do it, unless we found like an old journal from 20,000 years ago or like a piece of paper, which
that seems unlikely.
Right.
But
they had. I'm not going to really quote the first use of paper because I didn't really look at this, but it couldn't have been more than a few thousand years ago, because I know the Chinese were working with it. I know the Egyptians were doing it on papyrus, even up to maybe even 3,000 or 4,000 years ago. But again, not past that.
Yeah, for sure.
Everything before that was on clay tablets, and then stone before that.
Yeah.
So it would have to be rock art.
Yeah, for sure.
Or something crazy.
Yeah.
Or time travel.
Okay, let's not go there.
What?
You're getting into the pseudo range again.
Listen, it could always be time travel. I think ancient alien theorists are right, but it's just us.
It's just us.
Yeah.
From like
the
now.
Aliens.
Maybe like next year sometime, like
it could
pop back.
Be. Yeah, we're the aliens. Yeah. So
Oh my gosh. Okay, scratch all that. That's not real. So this article is another one that captured my attention because, like you said, you're pushing back the time frame on something that we thought we knew pretty well before. And like yeah. that always grabs me because I'm like, for real? And this one is cave drawings from 20,000 years ago may feature an early form of writing.
Yeah.
All right. So let's see why they're saying this. Lines and dots that are found throughout the cave paintings of Europe are usually also found with depictions of animals, right?
Okay.
Now, in a recent open access paper, which you guys can all go read, we're going to link to it in the show notes. But in this recent paper published by Cambridge University Press, amateur archaeologist Bennett Bacon presents the theory that three of these dot line symbols actually represent a like early form of written communication.
You mean like a group of three?
Yeah, there are three different ones. They don't necessarily show up together, but they do mean different things depending on what combination of them that they show up together.
Yeah, he thinks that the combination of these dots and lines actually represents sort of a rudimentary form of a lunar calendar.
Yeah.
Based specifically in the area where they're
found. Yeah, like they're very regional. They're very specific to the different cave and the different time period or whatever, but it's like kind of like a lunar calendar thing. And then the third symbol, so that was a dot. The dot and the line were the first two symbols they analyzed. And then the Y symbol is meant to represent giving birth. Mm. So when that Y symbol is combined with various lines and dots that are the calendar, this represents the lunar month that the animal that these symbols are depicted with is likely to give birth.
I mean, they show a picture of like, I don't know what that is, swordfish or something, or some sort of big fish.
Yeah.
And like, do we really know when those fish are giving, like,
honestly, that photo was the worst example they could have picked, because there's some other ones where it's like clearly some kind of large mammal type thing with lines and dots that like, okay, like they're right next to, and they're right next to like the belly of the mammoth or whatever it was that was depicted. And, you know, okay, fine. Yeah. Like I could buy that. Right.
Right. So if this is true, like we said, this could push back the earliest proto writing, and proto because it's not like letters and things that we would associate with writing.
Yeah.
There's other actual proto writing that dates back, you know, 10,000-12,000 years.
Yeah.
But it's also, again, not writing in the form that we necessarily know it. It's more symbols.
It's symbols. And,
yeah. Stuff like that. Yeah. So that's why they call it proto writing. Mm-hmm. But if this is true, it would push back our oldest knowledge of this by about 10,000 years. And that is based on the dating of this rock art, which is also subject to its own interpretation sometimes.
It certainly is.
Some rock art is easier to date than others, depending on how it was made and what it's associated with. But it's notoriously difficult to get it right.
Yeah.
So, as always, though, you already mentioned who actually did this, and I don't want to take anybody down for doing any sort of research that they're interested in or anything like that, but you do have to take it a little bit with a grain of salt that the person who is publishing this is an amateur archaeologist. They don't have the formal training. Not that
you
it's
don't
rocket
need
science.
It, but it's, yeah, it you're is not sending helpful people to the moon. To sort through what's a good observation and what's a bad observation and the scientific method and all that stuff that should be involved.
But it also sometimes takes somebody thinking outside the box from another industry to see something nobody else has seen before.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, and this is another. So obviously we're going to get to our skepticism on the results of this article, and we're getting there. But the other thing I want to point out before we really dig into it is you really do have to pay attention to your news source.
Yeah.
So when I first came across this article, it was in Popular Science, and it was presenting this article as truth, as this is the findings of these researchers, and this is now the new thing. 20,000 years ago, we have writing.
Yeah.
And I was like, that just, like, has anybody else reported on this? It just doesn't seem quite right. And then I saw that the author was an amateur, and I'm like, So then I went and found another article, and this was Smithsonian, which I know we quote them all the time, but I do like the way they report. And their article title was, "Could these cave markings be the earliest form of writing? ?
Right.
And it's a much more skeptical look at what these guys are saying and whether or not it's actually true.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've got links to both those articles so you can kind of compare how the two journalists took different approaches to presenting this study.
Yeah.
And then we also link to the study itself, which is an open access article, which you can go read. So just a really great little lesson on how you should really hold your journalistic sources to a high standard and call them on it if they don't seem accurate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Bennett Bacon. And you want to know what his job is? He is a London-based furniture conservator.
So he's in history.
Uh-huh.
He's a historian.
Uh-huh. An independent researcher.
Right.
Cool. Okay, that's fine. Sometimes people do think outside the box, and that's great. So what he did, he's got a long had a fascination with rock art. Again, great. He gathered images and formed a hypothesis. And then it basically seems like he like roped in some experts to help legitimize his ideas.
Right.
One of the researchers that he brought in is Tony Freeth, who is an honorary professor of mechanical engineering. And he has done a lot of work in deciphering the Antikythera mechanism, which is yet another thing that has a lot of pseudoscience mm-hmm. around it. I didn't really deep dive him and what he's like, whether or not he's accepted in the community right. as being, you know, a stand-up scientist. Well, but
it would take a mechanical engineer to understand the Antikythera device
yeah,
or mechanism.
It would. Yeah. It would. And Andrew Kinkella on the PseudoArc podcast, he has a great episode about it, which we can link to.
Yeah.
So anyway, these guys with Bennett Bacon being the leader here, they examined these marks in caves across Europe. According to the team, they are showing that the hunter-gatherers in the Ice Age were the first to use marks and a systemic calendar to document major ecological events, right? That's what their whole goal was. That's what they thought was happening. And it does seem like a logical conclusion, right? That people were using dots and lines to document things about the animals that they're near.
Right.
But they only look at 3 of the 32 well-documented recurring symbols
okay.
in rock art from across all kinds of different caves and all kinds of different time periods. There's so many symbols.
Mm-hmm.
So they only picked 3 of them.
Well, that's how rock art works, though. There's lots of symbols. So, yes, there's tons of them.
That's true. But how are you going to assign isolate. Meaning to these 3 yeah. and not and where those symbols overlap with each other, like what happens to the meaning when there's overlap? Like there's just a lot there that it sounds like they decided not to examine.
We call that Graham cocking the research. Listen to the Life in Ruins podcast if you want to know what that yeah. means.
I think that also means like cherry picking, right?
Oh yeah, I prefer Graham cocking.
Graham cocking is good.
Yeah.
So the other criticism of this study is that they don't address alternate theories for these marks either.
Yeah.
They just zero in on this one idea. And it really, really seems like it was a case of making the evidence fit your theory and make this pretty picture that you want rather than the other mm-hmm. way around.
Yeah. And the interesting thing to me is it's plausible.
It is.
Right?
Like, yeah.
If you go in with a hypothesis, and here's the thing, if they cherry pick these handful of symbols, and they go in with a hypothesis and then they can prove that. Like if you know what this dates to and you can walk it back and say, yeah, this animal actually gave birth at what I can read here as this month out of the year.
Mm-hmm.
That's hard to refute.
It is.
Right. So have they done that? Did you read anything about that, about whether or not they're able to actually make predictions based on these markings?
That I did not read anything about.
Yeah.
So I don't know that that was a part of their study. But you're right. That would be really interesting to know. I also want to know, like, when you get a cherry picking situation, which it already seems like they're doing here a little bit.
Yeah.
Did they cherry pick which cave drawings they wanted to include?
Right.
Like the ones that didn't show that were like the wrong month entirely for that animal to give birth. They just yeah. not include those, or I don't know. It doesn't say one way or another. And of course, who's going to like own up to that if.
Yeah.
You know, but I don't want to accuse them of being shady either. I just don't know.
Well, it also seems somewhat unlikely that a massive system, agreed upon system for doing this, would have been developed throughout this entire region, right?
Yeah.
Like, would everybody have just known that these symbols are how you catalog this?
Yeah. And that's another yeah. thing that was really unclear to me is like, is this all from one region or
yeah.
one group of people? Or like, what's the unifying thing? Because not every single group of humans 20,000 years ago would have been recording things the same way.
Yeah.
So you would have had some kind of variability, and how are they accounting for that, I guess, would be my next question.
Right.
So,
well,
we're not saying this isn't impossible.
Yeah,
it is definitely possible. But, you know, like I just remember having those kind of conversations where you're just like theorizing on why something is the way it is. at an archaeological site that you're working on, right? Like when I went to Peru, we would have all kinds of crazy conversations about what this wall over here meant. And it was it was theorizing and it was fun. And it's something that you always do, especially over, you know, a couple beers or whatever. Yeah. Like we always do that. But you have to be real careful.
True. Well, two things that help make those theories better and I guess more logical are the more you know about the culture and the cultures that have lived in that area, how likely is it that what you're saying is true, right? You initially want to look at stuff like that through the biases of your own upbringing, your own surroundings, your own life, or even like if you did all your work in North America and you all of a sudden you go to Peru for a season, like you're going to take all that North American knowledge and you're going to go down to Peru and go, oh, it's probably, you know, a game drive thing. And maybe those things are similar across continents and across cultures, but you know, you can't just assume that.
Yeah, it could, it could be totally different. It
could
be
totally different. So,
the last thing I just wanted to mention, because I just thought of this when I was reading this article, and I've never even read this book. You're the one who told me about it, I'm pretty sure. But it's a book called Motel of Mysteries. And we may have even talked about it on the podcast before.
I don't remember.
But it's basically, it's a book where it's an archaeological dig of modern day today.
Yeah.
And what future people will think of digging up a motel in from modern day today. And it's just all kinds of completely wrong theories and conclusions about what they're finding in this motel that's set up just like it would be today. And they're logical, though. You 100% see why they're drawing the conclusions that they do in the book. So it's sort of like a farcical, like, look at the assumptions that we make as scientists and archaeologists when we're looking at just the remains left behind by people. But anyway, it just reminded me of that because you got to be careful not to do that.
Right. And there was also an old article. I just had to look it up here, from 1956, actually written by Horace Minor, called Body Ritual Among the Nasirema, about doing this sort of analysis and being careful about what you're looking at. Nasirema is American spelled backwards. Oh, he made it up completely.
Right.
Yeah. So it was an American anthropologist in 1956. We'll link to that as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, somebody else who's in the news a lot and is always seems like trying to grab the spotlight. I'm not getting on him on it. I'd love to have him on the show.
But, I know, right?
Yeah, Zahi Hawass. But he's been quoted in an article, and this has been all over the place. So we're going to talk about it. But it's about the oldest mummy to have been found in Egypt with the best preservation. And it also happens to be wrapped in a ton of gold.
Yep.
So back in a minute. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 204. And we're going to talk about a 35-year-old man named Djed Sepsh. Djed Sepsh.
That's probably right. Yeah. Or close to.
Close to. Anyway, this article is, well, it's all over the place.
It is all over, yeah.
One of the ones we're linking to is from CNN Style, of all things.
I know.
Yeah.
But there's, all you have to do is type in old Egyptian mummy and you'll bring up like a whole bunch of different articles.
Yeah, so again, full of quotes from Zahi Hawass, who is Egypt's former antiquities minister. He was, I don't know if he was ousted from his job a while ago, but he was definitely always seeking like the spotlight. But he is like the face of Egyptian antiquities still.
He is.
You know, you think of the kind of, you know, kind of large, obviously dark-skinned Egyptian man like that you may have seen talking about mummies. It's Zahi Hawass that's in your head and you don't even know it.
Totally.
Yeah.
He just has his hands in every excavation going on, every major discovery, everything.
Well,
I don't know if people just go to him first for quotes and that's why, or if he's like in the background directing things. I don't know.
He's just very popular and a lot of people go to him and they know him and he's very knowledgeable as well. So,
well, I mean, you know, think
he's
about
got his
it.
Problems, but
like, what are the, I can think of two cultures that we always, always, always talk about new, important, interesting finds.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is anything from Egypt.
Yeah.
And the other one is anything from Rome.
Sure.
And I feel like there are just people in the background who are making sure that that stuff hits the news cycle and that there's press releases and we all find out about it. And you know what? It's working. So I'm sure there's some criticisms of the way that he handles things. But hey, we found out about this. So that's awesome.
He's basically Egyptian Indiana Jones.
Right.
All right. And what he's found, or not what he's found, but what he's
talked about. Yeah.
Anyway, it has nothing to do with him, to be honest with
you. No, it doesn't. He's just talking about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But this is a 4,300-year-old mummy.
Yeah.
I mean, just like, okay.
Take that
4,300 years. They buried him in the ground in a tomb. Yeah. Super popular dude, covered in gold.
Yeah.
And it's just like, this was 4,300 years ago.
Yeah, this
That's
is
almost hard to imagine.
It's before the Valley of the Gods. It's before Giza. It's before all of the big pyramids and the big landmarks that you can think of in Egypt. Mm-hmm. This is before all of that.
Yeah, and not only that, but he was found in just the people required to put this thing together.
But I know.
He was found in a 25-ton stone coffin.
Mm-hmm.
And when they opened the lid, which I have to imagine is going to be in a movie someday.
I know, right? It should be.
Right. It's going to go...
Yeah.
Right.
There's always air.
It's always like compressed somehow.
I don't know where that air is coming from.
Well, prehistoric stone was well known for its...
outgassing?
its compressing abilities and its impermeability to air.
Oh, right? I see. Yeah. I see. Sure.
It's a total lie.
Yeah.
Anyway, they opened the lid and it was just covered in layers of gold underneath.
Yeah.
There was a band on his head, a bracelet on his chest, everything covered in gold.
Yep.
So.
And we do know that, like you said earlier, that this is a 35-year-old man named, let's go with Jed Sepsh. Does that seem right?
It's Jed Sepsh.
Jed Sepsh.
DJ Ed. Well, I don't know what that was.
DJ.
DJ Ed. S-E-P-S-H. I'm just going to call him DJ from now on.
DJ sounds good.
Yeah.
I think he was known because there's actual like hieroglyphics to go along with all this. So well, that's how they know his actual name.
Even ancient Egyptian hieroglyphs have basically been translated at this point. So we know what's going on there.
And he was found way below the surface, 20 meters or 66 feet underground at the Jazir El Mudir enclosure.
Right. Now, that sounds like a long ways, and it is right now. But sandstorms in Egypt are real.
Yeah, they blow.
And over 4,000 years.
Yeah.
I mean, he was almost definitely buried underground in this underground tomb that was created, right? But it may have only been a couple meters below ground back then.
Yeah,
you know,
true.
Or something.
True, true.
So it may have only been a couple meters below ground 20 years ago.
It could be. Yeah, it does move fast and it moves a lot. Yeah. So that's true.
And there's a famous step pyramid there in the village of Saqqara, which we've actually talked about probably a number of times on this show.
Yeah, I think we have.
And it was near the actual, just the ancient step pyramid of Djoser.
Yeah. And that step pyramid was the first pyramid that the ancient Egyptians ever built. And this was between 2667 and 2648 BCE. And it was during the early third dynasty and is known as the oldest ancient Egyptian stone structures, like basically the first pyramid that they ever built. And it stepped because they were still trying to figure out that right kind of construction to get to that pyramid shape that they were going for. But they couldn't get those like smooth flat sides yet from an engineering perspective, I guess. Yeah. So they've got the steps, but eventually they do figure it out and they get the nice like flat sides that you think of when you think of a pyramid.
Yeah, they actually found two tombs as well. And one of them dated back to the reign of King Unas during the Fifth Dynasty. Mm-hmm. And that dates to between 2494 and 2487 BC. But, you know, since he wasn't covered in gold, we're really not talking about him.
Right.
Yeah. They found tons of stuff, though, too, as with any burial. I mean, it's clear that for 4,000 years, this burial hasn't been found.
Yeah.
Or it was found and they couldn't get the lid off.
That's entirely possible, yeah. But you would think the other stuff would have been taken if it hadn't been found.
You'd
like
think,
they found a bunch of statues, and that includes three different statues that represent the same person.
That's
so
crazy.
That was kind of neat. Yeah. I don't know if it's like a progression through life, so younger to older, or if it's just three different depictions by different artists.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it probably is different depictions by different artists, because they're saying that this gives them some insight into the art of the Old Kingdom, which they hadn't really had before. So if you have the same thing depicted by multiple artists, then that will give you sort of that range of art that you might see in an area.
I wonder why they don't have examples of that. They've definitely found burials before, but I wonder if it was just they've been looted, or maybe they don't have that many that are of this like glamorous nature.
Maybe.
You know?
And it might just be like, if you don't have that thing tying it together, it's hard to categorize things and identify like what you're looking at. So yes, you have art, but you don't really know exactly how it fits together, maybe.
Yeah.
But having three of the same thing by different people, you get something to sort of ground you in your interpretation of what art was like for them back then.
Right. So as I mentioned, there were two tombs found, but again, the biggest, the real reason why we're not talking about that one, not because he's not covered in gold. He may be covered in gold.
He might be covered in gold.
He may be a she.
Yeah.
But it hasn't been opened yet.
Yeah.
So hopefully by the time this comes out, maybe they will have opened it. We'll talk about that on the next show.
It's possible. Yeah. Because I think this article dates to January 27th. So, you know, if it's going to be open next week, then maybe it'll have been open by the time we air this episode, or they'll be about to soon. So there might be more information to add to this at that point.
Right. Yeah. Sounds good. Yeah. So the cemetery here, and again, This is a Zahi Hawass quote.
Yeah.
But he says it was likely, really, Zahi, likely because you found somebody covered in gold. But it was likely a cemetery for the very rich and important members of society, second after the king.
Right? Yeah.
So the king gets the pyramid.
Yep.
And everybody else gets these. Now, I'm making fun of Zahi Hawass because he's famous for saying stuff like that. But he also knows what he's talking about.
Yeah.
And if you start finding one glamorous tomb, you're not going to bury a bunch of poor peasants next to them.
Right.
Unless they're that person's slaves, which has been done before.
Right.
But you're also going to, you know, you're going to like begets like, right?
Yeah.
So they're going to, you know, bury the same type of classed people in the same areas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It is interesting that the Step Pyramid dates to 200 years before these tombs. Because it's just like, what was going on with the leaders in between there? Where were they buried? I don't have a good enough understanding of like that history of that time period to know, like, because these were rich members of the society. Where was the leader that they were?
Well,
they were underneath, you know?
Something I also don't understand about Egyptian society is there have been many pharaohs,
yeah,
many leaders, many rulers.
Many.
But we have, you know, just a few dozen pyramids.
Yeah.
When you look at the really small ones,
I guess,
too.
What that means is that pyramids fell in and out of favor, just like anything does. So they didn't always get one.
They were just really expensive to do. Like,
yeah, true.
Like the Step Pyramid of Djoser, he's like, okay, great. You're going to bury me here. It took us 100 years to make this.
Yeah.
And, well, 20 years to make this.
Yeah.
And, you know, everybody else was like, okay, but that's it.
But
and
cool.
And then it took a few generations.
We're not doing that again.
Yeah. Like, remember that pyramid we built? What a dick that guy was.
No way.
Yeah, so we're not going to do that anymore. So, yeah.
Yeah, totally.
Anyway. All right. Well, that's all we got this week. And maybe next week we'll be talking about the even more gold wrapped around the other,
yeah,
the other mummy in the coffin.
You know what? We'll keep an eye out for it and give it a mention at least. Even if we're not doing a news episode, we'll give it a mention for sure.
I mean, it probably is pretty well stacked, unless that one was looted, but they usually don't put the lids back on. So.
No, probably not. Yeah. If the coffin's not open and they don't know what's inside of it.
If it's in the same area, Zahi Hawass is probably right. Even though it's much older, there's a reason the second guy was buried there.
Yeah,
right?
For sure.
And that probably tracks with the first guy. So,
yeah.
Or girl. I don't know.
Yeah.
But they say that they know the date of the last one from the 5th dynasty. So they didn't mention his name, though. I don't know why. Maybe it's not on the outside.
I'm not sure if they're releasing that information yet, or if they're just trying to, you know, keep the surprise factor or the wow factor or something. I don't know. But I guess we'll find out when they choose to share it with us. If they choose to share it with us. Because that's the other thing is maybe it'll just fade away if it's not like important enough to talk about.
Maybe.
Yeah.
All right. Well, with that, we will get on to recording our RVing podcast so you can not be subject to that here, although we'll still talk about
this. No way.
Here.
I'm going to have some tacos.
Oh, yeah. Tacos. Hashtag Mexico.
Yep.
All right. See you next week.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ArcPodNet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.